This is the session on God, language, gender, and prayer. Rosemary Ruther, and we're going to talk today particularly on the biblical revolution in God language in relationship to its ancient Near Eastern setting. Got that tape, Minister? Okay. So, as I said, I want to talk about the biblical revolution in God language in relationship to its ancient Near Eastern setting, which is to say, in relationship to the religions of the ancient Near East, the Sumero-Akkadian traditions that began really with Sumer and developed in the Babylonian world, and of course the particular context was the Canaanite religious world, which was a part of that larger ancient Near Eastern world. Now, yesterday I mentioned views of post-Christian. The word post-Christian is a bit misleading because some of the people, of course, never were Christians but were Jews, like Starhawk. But in any case, a kind of feminism that seeks both to discount and reject the biblical Jewish and Christian traditions, and in some ways to go back behind it to ancient pagan traditions, or what they think of as goddess traditions, goddess religions, which, as I said, I think they see through the lenses of certain kind of feminist ideals and values, namely woman-centered society and spirituality of mutuality, nurture, and care for the earth. Now, I suggest that these are great values, but I don't think they necessarily give us an accurate view of any ancient paganism I know, or specifically the religions of the ancient Near East. So I see that as a biased and largely unhistorical view, if one is talking specifically about those religions, over against which the Hebrew Yahwist movement, if you want to call it that, situated itself. The word Yahweh, by the way, is one that is deeply offensive to Jews. I don't know if you realize that. Because it's a kind of arrogant Christian notion that we can pronounce a symbol which was intended by the Jews to be unpronounceable. And so such a word does not exist in Judaism. It's interesting that I was taught the word Yahweh by Christian biblical scholars when I was an undergraduate about 20 years ago, and only last year did I realize for the first time from Jews that they don't like that word. Anyway, but certainly there was some kind, however you term it, there was a Hebrew religious movement expressed in the scriptures that Christians call the Old Testament that is certainly situating itself over against that ancient Near Eastern world. If the post-Christian feminists give us a biased view, I think we have inherited an equally biased and largely unhistorical picture when we look at those religions through the eyes of a biblically based hostility to them and see them merely as idol worshipers, or devil worshippers, and of course sex maniacs running amok in the streets. So in other words, in order to have a just evaluation of what the biblical revolution in God language is really about, I think we have to have a more just, a truer historical picture of the religions out of which it arose. And it's important to remember that the Hebrew religions rose out of that ancient Near Eastern world. So the religions out of which they arose and transformed in some ways, and in some ways situated themselves over against it. So first of all, let me try to say some very general things about what I see as the characteristics of the God language specifically of the Canaanite ancient Near Eastern world. First of all, this was not a religion of a goddess. That's one of the kind of peculiar myopias of the modern feminist view, as to see a sort of a goddess religion being overthrown by a patriarchal god religion, as though they were kind of, you know, a goddess monotheism over against a patriarchal monotheism. Clearly, these were not a religion of a goddess, but rather a religion that viewed deity as a community and as a family, which is to say a whole community or family of deities, which, like all families, come in two genders, that they're both males and females, and that they're, which is to say, gods and goddesses, but also, like families, come in several generations. So you might say deity, as we get the picture from the Canaanite world, also from the Greek world, is the deity is like a big multi-generational family, obviously, of both males and females, and so that you have at least three generations. You have the old gods, mothers, or the old, you might say the grandmothers and the grandfathers, who are seen as kind of shadowy, somewhat not quite human shapes. I mean, partly human, partly sort of bestial shapes of great primordial forces. These are the grandmother, father gods and goddesses. And then there's sort of the mother-father gods and goddesses. And then there are the sibling gods and goddesses. And so the deity, shall we say, comes in two genders, and it's certainly at least three generations. And like all families, they are presented as loving and quarreling with each other, which is to say the deity, this family of deity is typically extremely passionate, which of course is a big difference between our assumptions, although the Hebrew God is also quite a passionate God, but certainly the ancient Near Eastern gods and goddesses were passionate. They loved each other passionately, they quarreled with each other passionately. There's a scene in the story of Anath and Baal where Anath, who passionately loves her brother Baal, storms up to confront her father El about the fact that Baal's prerogatives are being abused, and she storms into his inner chamber and she pulls his beard. and El sort of is like this kind of squeaky old man. He says, "Oh, what would you, my lovely daughter?" You know, and so I mean, they're kind of a passionate, quarreling and loving lot. Again, very much modeled after real families rather than Christian education model families. A second aspect of ancient Near Eastern understanding of deity is that deity evolves within the evolution of the cosmos itself. Whereas deity does not stand outside the cosmos as some pre-existing divine power that's there from all eternity. But the cosmos sort of evolves from kind of inchoate, chaotic forms to more and more formed structures of city and state and leadership, and the gods sort of evolve within it. And so the generations of the gods, in a real sense, represents this kind of theogony. And so if you look at the ancient Near Eastern stories of the beginnings, what you see is, first of all, a theogony. Everybody know what a theogony is? A theogony means the genesis of the gods. Gani, you know, is a process, evolution, and failure is obviously God. So that ancient Near Eastern stories about how things began start with theogonies. And Hesiod, who is the Greek author of a similar document about the beginnings, he titles his story of how things began as the theogony. So cosmogony, which is the evolution of the cosmos, is really kind of the reflection of theogony. So I think that's a second important aspect that's fundamentally different from our assumptions, is the gods are within the cosmos. They evolve. And they evolve precisely from more inchoate forms to more anthropomorphic forms and more and forms that are more specifically related to images of leadership, of the ordered city-states of the ancient Near East. And then thirdly, a third aspect of ancient Near Eastern images of gods is that they are imaged, they are kind of a divine social class. Which is to say that even though they may quarrel and fight with each other, the gods represent a kind of class that all participate in one kind of life. And basically, they are a kind of immortalization perfection of the ideals of a certain kind of aristocratic ruling class. And so the very essential metaphor for the gods in the ancient Near Eastern world is that they are a leisure class, that they do not work. And that's a very fundamental idea. You have in one of the very earliest stories of the gods and the origins of human beings that goes back to ancient Sumer, you have a story in which it basically says that once upon a time, only the gods existed and there were no humans, and the gods had to do all their own work. And at one point, the gods went on strike, and they threw down their pickets and shovels, and they said, "We are not working anymore." And so the gods got together, and they created human beings to be the servants, the workers, so that the gods would not have to work, but could be at leisure. And the same idea is repeated in the classic Babylonian creation story. I don't know if any of you read ancient Near Eastern mythology. Some of you. Okay, there's a classic ancient Near Eastern creation story, which was really read ritually every year as a part of a New Year's festival. And in it tells the story of how Marduk, the champion of the gods and goddesses, defeats the old mother Tiamat, who represents the disordered old world of primal chaos. And he splits her body up and he creates the cosmos out of her body. And then at the end of that, after creating the cosmos out of her body, he takes the blood of her slain consort and mixes it with clay, and he makes the human beings. And it says specifically, he makes the human beings to do the work so that the gods may be at leisure. So you might say the very fundamental model is that gods are like a leisured ruling class, aristocratic class, who can enjoy life because there is a serving class who does the work. And so you might say the basic metaphor that is very deeply established in ancient Near Eastern mythology is gods are to humans as leisure class to working class. Now, one of the typical stereotypes that we tend to get about goddesses is that they are fertility fetishes. And of course, we all assume that fertility is somehow a very bad thing, although we're obviously interested in it ourselves in various ways for our fields. And if you're a farmer, you're very interested in it. And even if you're a city dweller, you're somewhat interested in it if you want to have children. And obviously, the ancient Near Eastern world was preeminently interested in fertility because that was life. And that meant the whole issue of the promoting and supporting the life-giving powers of the soil, rain, and so on to support the harvest. Shut up, you contemplatives. somebody should shout, contemplatives should be quiet. So fertility of land, animals, and people was obviously the preeminent concern of farming people. But it is quite wrong to say that female deities have any more connection with fertility than male deities. In fact, all gods and goddesses are equally fertility. But fertility is only a part. In other words, what we need to correct is the notion that somehow female deity means fertility. in some way, whereas male deity doesn't, whereas in fact all of the gods and goddesses are part of a religious symbol system that aims at the promotion of fertility, but it also aims at the promotion of social order and social justice. And so the much more important imagery of the gods and goddesses than mother or rain or something like that is in fact kings and queens. And if you really want to give the most important name to Anath or Ishtar, any of the ancient goddesses, the most appropriate name would be queen, and not necessarily mother, because motherhood, in other words, they are very far from our modern sentimental notions about nurturing mothers, and what most of the characteristics of the ancient goddesses are very similar to the ancient gods, which is to say that they are preeminently sovereigns, that they represent a powerful ruling class, and that people pray to them to get help. And they pray to them to get help for two things. First of all, they pray to them for help in promoting prosperity, fertility, and so on. But they also pray for them for help for protection against their enemies. Which, of course, is again very much what you find in the Psalms. In fact, the Psalms in the Old Testament are modeled directly after Psalms of the ancient Near East, and have practically the same kinds of concerns. You know, protect me from my enemies. You know, my enemies surround me and are beating me down, and my life is draining out. You know, oh, turn to me, oh Lady, and help me. That's the kind of language you find in Psalms in the ancient Near East as well in the Bible. So as I said, it's when we look at this basic notion that gods are to humans as rulers to rule, one must not imagine that this was invented by Hebrew religion. It is the most fundamental metaphor that goes at least back to ancient Sumer. And at least at that point, the biblical tradition inherited, and as I will argue, partly modified, a tradition that was simply taken for granted. So what I'd like to then go on and say is what I see as some of the really key elements of change or transformation in what I would call the Hebrew revolution of God language. And I see three important changes. First is monotheism. Second is transcendence. And the third is liberation. Now let me try to talk about a little bit about all three of these. Again, I want to make clear that the Hebrew revolution comes out of a common ancient Near Eastern stock of ideas. Even while it positions itself in critique of it, it takes over and transforms many ideas that were earlier. But I think monotheism is itself an idea that grows gradually. Some of you who've done ancient biblical studies know that some of the earliest ideas of you know, our God alone shall you worship has more to do with saying this, our tribal God, is the only God which you, this tribe, will worship, and not that this is the only God that exists anyplace. So monotheism is an idea that grows gradually. It's a very long time before anybody can imagine there's only one God of the whole cosmos, because it's a big change to even be able to think of the whole cosmos anyway, rather than your tribe. But in any case, I think that is an important development toward an increasingly unified idea of God as one divine person being, and not a plurality of even a family of gods and goddesses. So I would like to ask the question, does monotheism, by its very nature, promote a more patriarchal concept of God? One of the people that has argued that is a Jewish feminist scholar by the name of Judith Oxhorn, who's written a book let's see if I can remember. It's a somewhat misleading title. Well, I'm actually losing it. Something about female reality and the gods. I'll get a more exact one. But what she's basically trying to do, and if you look up her name, it's the only book that she's written for, Indiana University Press, is to talk about ancient Near Eastern polytheism vis-a-vis Hebrew monotheism. And she argues that monotheism, by its very nature, promotes a more patriarchal concept of God, because there's only one God, and that God is male. And so as soon as you have only one God and that God is male, then you introduce something which really didn't belong to polytheism, which is that males are godlike and females aren't. Presumably you'd have the same effect if you had only one God and that God is female. You know, that females are godlike and males are not. So there's a problem when you've got two genders and only one God. Which gender is favored? And certainly, if you have the notion of monotheism, which is a male one single God, then the idea of male hierarchy, male over female, becomes fused with the idea of the gods, the divine, as ruler over ruled. So male over female, ruler over rule, get combined together, and you have male ruler over female ruled, which is, I think, what we, in fact, very much end up with, as I was talking about yesterday. However, I would like to suggest that there are very important countervailing trends in the biblical tradition which I think do or should have mitigated against that, and certainly can be evoked and developed today as a kind of counter force to the tendency to have a single male God who then somehow makes maleness more godlike than femaleness. And I'll just mention what I see as some of these aspects of the biblical revolution of monotheism that should have critiqued the notion that the one God is male, and therefore males are more godlike than females. First of all, the whole sense that this one God is really beyond any literal anthropomorphic imagery, which I think is very basic to biblical faith, that there is one God, and this God really cannot be literally named or imaged at all. And to do so is a blasphemy, idolatry, and so on. That's part of what makes Jews very mad when we proceed to boldly pronounce the word that they deemed as precisely the symbol of the unpronounceability, unnameability of God. And I think that whole concept is very important for saying that all of our language for God are partial metaphors, but as soon as we start taking any image literally, we are idolaters and blasphemers against the nature of God. And that's particularly true if we take an image drawn from one gender or one race or something and say that group is more godlike than others. It was taking metaphors of that kind literally in a way that makes God a source of discrimination among people. So I think one very important thing that should have critiqued that, as I said, is that strong sense that there is one God, but this God's nature is beyond all of our literal images, and any taking of our imagery literally is misleading. Another very important aspect is that, in fact, that although male metaphors predominate, but I would say in the Old Testament it's really ruler images that predominate, which again is a much older idea, and rulers didn't necessarily come in the male gender. So it's ruler images that predominate, not necessarily male images. And you clearly have female images as well. You have female images at a number of points, which I'm sure Mary Chandler is bringing out. A lot of these female imagery has tended to be suppressed in our translation, precisely because of a much later dogmatism, the god must be male, and so, you know, the breasted one certainly doesn't mean the breasted one, means the mighty one.
Does today.
Yeah, it does today, or the language that Phyllis Trible brings out about God, the word for God's compassion is really comes from the Hebrew word for womb, and so you're really talking about God's womb agony. If God has womb agony, you assume God has a womb, which is not one of the standard biological equipment of males. And that tends to get translated as God's loins. Again, you talk about around God's womb. So there is, in fact, a lot of female-identified imagery. And I think the importance of this is precisely to indicate that the ancient Hebrews understood that their language was metaphor. In fact, I would say that most Christians understood that till about the 17th century. I mean, sort of the modern scientific literalism, which has tended to destroy the understanding of religious language as poetry. But certainly the ancient Hebrews understood their language was imagery, and that in talking about God as a person, you could indeed draw from imagery of both males and females. And so a lot of there's... And all of that, again, is to indicate that they understood that God was not literally of the male gender. But, yeah?
Can you say a little bit more about the concept of the gods as rulers? Because you seem to pass very easily from the concept of the gods as the leisure class to the gods as rulers.
Well, leisure class and rulers, they're the same group.
But isn't it quite a difference? And initially, it was the leisure class.
No, it was the ruler. It was a ruler leisure class. I said that the key image for the gods and goddess was queen. That's an image of a sovereign ruler. Now you may think rulers work, but one of the things about rulers is that they command a lot of property and servants, so that they have a lot of leisure. And was the we have this notion that somehow it's the monopoly of high status work that makes high class people. But I think that's partly a lie for our society too. But in fact, it's the monopoly of leisure that is what power is all about. Making other people do most of the work so you can enjoy the fruits of their labor, and you can issue commands, but you don't work very hard. In fact, you don't work at all. You just issue commands. So that's what ancient ruling about, and that's what a lot of our ruling is about. I mean, Ronald Reagan gets long naps. He sleeps. He has a lot of leisure. He sleeps a lot. So we have to kind of see the way leisure and power historically has gone together, certainly in antiquity. And it's only, in relatively modern times that ruling classes have had to pretend that they work. It's a modern Puritan revolution.
But are you really quite confident that the leisure did not precede the ruling?
No, I'm very confident that they connect together.
From
the beginning. Yeah.
Would you say a few words about the warrior god?
You don't have a leisure class that's not a ruling class. There's no possibility of a leisure class that's not a ruling class. Because the whole possibility of being a ruler, I'm here to tell you that I think it's impossible to be a leisure class unless you monopolize power and wealth from other people's work. That's what leisure is precisely that.
It is in our country where the leisure class, which isn't a part of the government, has to make darn sure that the government stays in favor of the leisure class, including better tax breaks and the
business. I mean, it means that you have a great deal of unearned wealth coming in, and that's because you monopolize
power.
The critique
of Amos, I think, is a good example of that, of the rulers and the leisure, drinking wine in bowls and man couches.
Sure, yeah, really.
Yes. Yeah. Can you say something about the warrior god image and how that would relate?
Well, I think that the monopoly of leadership of war, and I've, again, the people who are leading the wars usually don't endanger themselves too much being killed themselves. I mean, they throw those other people out in the front lines while they organize the war. So I think military power, political power, and monopoly of wealth are just all interconnected with each other. And so the Anath does a, she's a bit of a military goddess as well as a queen, as well as you know, enjoying life generally. So I think these are all part of the same pattern. Although it seems to me that, I mean, I'd have to have people who spend more time specifically studying this ancient Near Eastern stuff, of which I'm much more of a secondary scholar. But it seems to me that the military aspect is more predominant in Hebrew thought than in the ancient Near Eastern thought. But I'm not really sure of that. Anybody know about that? But certainly I think these things are connected. Always the Anath is not a peace pacifist. I mean, one of her key aspects is leading a kind of, she's a goddess of battles. She leads a war to defeat the enemies of Baal. And then, but her defeat of the enemies of Baal is also then intertwined with agriculture. She defeats drought and death and resurrects him. So these imagery of war and defeating drought and death, these are interconnected. And I think that we, obviously a lot of military imagery comes into our tradition that has been partly sublimated to mean other things, like fighting for righteousness or whatever. Okay, let me just finish up. The whole idea, as I said, of monotheism, of a one God. What I'm trying to say is that a one God doesn't necessarily mean it could, and I think more appropriately, be construed as a concept of divine unity that transcends particularities of gender, race, and so on, and provides a kind of divine unity that underlies all of our personhood, male and female. And therefore, that although the one God is not literally either male or female, or Jew or Greek or whatever, but nevertheless, one can draw images of God from both male and female, as well as from all kinds of human experiences. Later on in the week, I hope to talk about the whole problem of metaphor and how we distinguish more or less appropriate metaphor. The second aspect that I want to talk about is transcendence. In other words, a shift from the idea of deity evolving within the cosmos to the idea of pre-existent deity existing before, above the world, sort of creating the world through a kind of fiat, a kind of a word act, but not really being in it, or the world not really sort of being the fleshing out of the evolution of deity. And I think that this, the transcendence, has tended, particularly when it's combined with Greek ideas of sharp division between the immutable and the mutable, between spirit and body. Because I think we've inherited an idea of God that fuses a Hebrew idea of transcendence and a Greek idea of dualism. And so that we've been led to think of God as the kind of immutable, immovable first principle of Aristotle, who doesn't get mixed up in body stuff, but sort of rules it from above. And I think that model lends itself to both a kind of authoritarian concept of God, but also a kind of invulnerable God. And that we get to God again by sort of turning away from all that's vulnerable and material and changeable and mutable and all that bad stuff. But I think that kind of transcendence is really only partially true of the biblical tradition. and has been, I said, very much exaggerated by the way we've connected it with Greek philosophy. And I think, again, there's a lot of countervailing trends in the biblical tradition. First of all, although God is seen as sort of outside the world and above it, he's not that far outside of it. He's usually kind of just up there a little bit, you know? And again, tends to be hardly the immutable, immovable God. I mean, God is, in the Bible, is again, a very passionate, he's sort of an anxious parent type, you know, male and female, anxious parent. And so this God is always sort of agonizing over God's people and changing his mind. He's mad, and then he repents and changes his mind. If, you know, if you repent, God is referred to, for example, in Jonah as repenting, changing his mind. So this is again still drawn from certainly very human images about changeability and passion and concern and suffering. And I think that this is carried further in the Christian tradition, which, and of course that's partly true in Hebrew thought as well, that seeks to balance the idea of God being outside and above with God being immanent, and talks about God's wisdom as God's immanent presence within creation, and sees the created world as a kind of bodying forth or expression of God's immanent presence. Again, it's interesting that the Jewish tradition tends to image the immanence of God in terms of female personification. So there's a whole tradition of immanence, of God not just being outside of, but as God's creating the world by a kind of bodying forth of God's wisdom and presence as the foundation and ground of being. As Tillich, of course, drew on that tradition in his term ground of being, God is the ground of being. and then the whole Christian tradition of the crucified God, precisely this immanent God being expressed in a human incarnation that enters into the most acute opposites of all human immutability and invulnerability, which is to say suffering and death. And early Christianity clearly had a lot of problems trying to balance that idea of God suffering with God's transcendence. I mean, that was clearly an absolutely shocking and intolerable idea to the Greek philosophical world. And so the only way early Christianity could handle that was be to kind of split a kind of immutable father from a mutable son who suffers. And I don't think we've still quite figured out what that's all about theologically. More recent efforts to get God more into the act of presence within creation is process theology, which sees God not simply as acting upon, but also being acted upon by our response, and so that God is involved and takes up and gathers up into God's self the whole process of human response to God and so on. So I think that these are efforts to, aspects of Christian theology that tend to balance out a tendency to see transcendence primarily in terms of a kind of immutable otherness, unconnected with process and vulnerability. And then I think the third very important aspect is God as liberator. And it seems to me that this is where the Hebrew tradition departs or critiques most dramatically the ancient Near Eastern idea. Certainly the ancient Near Eastern ideas had certain notions of gods like kings and queens being ones who dispense justice and who on certain occasions, like their coronation, for example, would liberate captives and assist widows. And so there's a language of that kind, but it tends to be more kind of kingly benevolence And it seems to me that the Jewish tradition took that notion of kingly establishment of justice and mercy and took it in a much more radical direction of a God who doesn't just dispense justice and mercy like a king, but a God who actually sides with the oppressed. A God who chooses a people who are enslaved by the greatest empire of the ancient Near East and leads them out of slavery. I think the prophetic tradition carries that on by having the God who sides with the dispossessed, the widows and the orphans, in a way that then critiques unjust power. Critiques unjust power in order to, you might say, in a more reformist way, to call it to renew its commitment to being just rulers, or it can be taken in a more radical way as suggesting that God, in fact, will actually overthrow unjust rulers and bring about a new era of peace and justice. The mighty will be put down from their thrones, the lowly lifted up. All that kind of language is a language that suggests that the liberator God is about creating a more a world of peace and justice that stands in some kind of critical relationship to unjust political and social systems. And needless to say, Hebrew Scripture and New Testament tend to get rather concrete about that. You know, they sort of name names, which they didn't like in that time any more than they do now. Herod, you fox, says Jesus. Okay, so I think that kind of liberator God is a very important aspect. And I think that element gets woven into some important shifts of meaning in ancient God language. I think there's a shift of meaning in terms of God as king and ourselves as servant of God. That, again, that's a very a pre-biblical image, king and servant. But I think there's a biblical shift of meaning in which God as king means that you are freed from allegiance to human kings. And Jesus uses that language for father. Because God is father, you should call no man father. So that there's a use of this kind of language for God not to reinforce divine ruler images, but in fact to free us from human ruler images. So I think that's a very fundamental shift. And that we in turn are servants of God, not by being good servants of Caesar, but in fact by being freed from servitude to Caesar. So, and now because the king servant language is still there, there's always a tendency for it to drift back into the old function of simply sanctifying kings and good servants. But I think the key biblical shift here is in fact to use that language in a critical way, that God alone is the true king, the true sovereign. And when one takes God as one's sovereign, one is no longer under the sovereignty of any human Caesar. To be servants of God is to be freed from servitude to human systems of power and so on. And I think that's a very key aspect of the New Testament understanding of Jesus as servant. I mean, Jesus does not get crucified by recommending being good servants to Caesar, obviously, but because his servanthood is a fundamental freeing from servitude to the existing political and religious power. So I think, as I said, there's a key shift in the meaning of those ideas. It's part of the prophetic tradition.
I think, did Jesus go along with that?
I think Jesus very much developed that. That's one of the areas where he's doing some creative stuff in God language. And precisely in terms of the Christ image, saying that Messiah comes as servant, not as king, certainly one of the things that his hearers didn't want to hear. And as
so what about the render unto Caesar and to God, that one?
Well, I think that that's one of the areas that Christians have completely misunderstood in a Platonic direction. was to any Jew of the first century, rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's, is when you're looking at the coinage of the Roman Empire, is Caesar's money, giving back that. What belongs to God is the land of Israel. and Caesar has no right to the land of Israel. So it's a very political statement, and we've turned it into a Platonic statement, which is render to God prayer and be good servants of the political masters. And I think that's not at all what the meant originally. So anyway, that's just a... another thing I want to mention, which I see as a very important revolution, is the priestly Genesis 1 text, which, of course, we think of it as the beginning of the Bible. In fact, of course, it's a late text. And I think it's a late text that's developed very much in critique of the ancient Near Eastern creation story. If you remember the ancient Near Eastern creation story, it creates humans so that the gods can be at leisure. They can rest. And also that humans that are modeled after slaves and not after gods. The Genesis story says humans are created in the image of God, male and female, which means that humans are not created as slaves, but rather as stewards and representatives of God. And secondly, God both works and rests, and God enjoins humans to both work and rest. So that's, I think there's a very interesting critique of the notion that God, the gods and aristocrats rest and people and humans and servants work. God works and God rests, and humans are to work and to rest. Precisely an imitation of God. And then I think a third aspect of that is that this image of God in the original text, and I think appropriately, promotes a radical equality between all human beings, male and female, as well as any other social distinctions that might exist, because everyone equally are in the image of God. And again, we have all kinds of ways that that has been deflected and distorted, but I think if you take it seriously, that really means that one has to encounter any other human being as the image of God. So I think there's a radical egalitarianism and a sense of humans as representing God's, I would say, care for the earth, not rule over the earth in that kind of later notion that's involved there. And it seems to me it's shaped very much in critique of the dominant ancient Near Eastern model of humans as slaves of the gods, so that the gods can rest. So all of that is simply to say that I think that there are elements in the ancient Near Eastern shift, biblical shift that is moving toward monotheism, transcendence, and liberation. There are elements in that, particularly the way you construe monotheism and transcendence, that can move to a more authoritarian and patriarchal God. But if we take in other elements of that, particularly in connection with the liberation direction, we certainly should have moved in a different direction, and that there is certainly ample material there to develop a very different model of God that does not promote either male or class domination, but promotes very much freedom, unity, and mutuality among people and as stewards of God's creation of the earth. So we've got, sounds like the contemplatives are quieted down, so we've got to see. Questions about that, yeah?
Well, Mary, but doesn't that last proposal, namely the notion of God becoming king rather than being ruled over by these other rules, doesn't even that need to be pushed further? I mean, that's where I think the awkwardness often arrives when I'm in dialogue with other liberation theologians, and I say, hey,
You mean that God alone is king, and
well, yeah, because of how quickly then that becomes,
yeah. Well, see, I mean, I think people were the yeah, I think the biblical language is using is using a common stock of ideas of God is like a king and humans is like servants. And it's doing some creative shifts of meaning, but it's not really changing, I mean, it's trying to change the content of the imagery, but I think imagery still tends to, it's so based on that pattern that we probably, and especially since we don't even have a societies of, literally of kings and servants, I mean, in other words, I think this is where one needs to create new God language precisely in order to translate better the creative tendencies of those earlier shifts. It was I don't think the king and servant quite does it, but I think we can try to unpack the creativity of that earlier shift, which is God is king who frees you from human kingship, and we are servants of God is free from servitude, and then try to find a language that speaks more fully to that today, and that isn't still based on that kind of power model. Yeah?
You suggested that the metaphors, the imagery, was there and working until about the 17th century.
No, what I'm saying is that people, there was a better understanding of, particularly of gender imagery, as metaphorical, and that God is not literally male. I'd have to modify that, because I think there's sort of two traditions that run down, a scholastic and a mystical tradition. And the scholastic tradition tends much more to be literal than that. You know, Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, right down. I mean, they really think that God is male and males are more godlike than females. And then there's a mystical tradition that I think preserves a more metaphorical understanding, and which with no difficulty at all talks about Christ having breasts and us being fed like babes from his breasts, and Christ who is our very mother, and all that kind of language, which is, and I mean, you could read mystics, and in virtually, you know, the same sentence, have them shift from male to female imagery and back again. So I think it's the mystical tradition that has that preserves a much more of a sense that of our language is metaphorical and poetic. And I think that mystical tradition lost out in the 17th century. That's part of what John Schramm's trying to reclaim, I think, for a more scholastic and scientific literal language, and that tries to emulate a scientific literal language.
I can't remember where it is, but was there not also an allegorical interpretation in there somewhere?
Well, the whole medieval world assumed that historical interpretation of the Bible was simply one sort of beginning point, and that there were several other meanings, one of them allegorical, and another was, I think it was called teleological, I remember all that, but it had to do with the vision of the future life. And I think we've been told that one of the great advances of possibly the Reformation, certainly modern biblical studies, is that we understand the historical meaning is not only the true meaning, but the only meaning. And I'd like to suggest to you that that's absolute nonsense. That nobody who preaches a sermon stays with the literal historical meaning. If they did so, they'd just be telling people about archaeology. They'd be saying, well, guess what? Now, this is the first Corinthian, these people in Corinth in the first century were doing thus and so. And they, you know, they tell you a historical tale about these first Corinthians. Nobody preaching a sermon doing that. They start out with historical Jesus, and then they do allegory, which is, or metaphor, or what I would call midrash, which is to say they start translating it. They take out a kind of kernel of some kind of insight or liberating message, and they recontextualize it to some context today. And nobody can tell me that's exegesis. But it is exegesis in a historical sense. But it is a translation, a recontextualization. So I think we need to be more honest about the several senses of Scripture that we assume. But because we don't own up to any but historical, we're always sort of pretending that that's all we're doing, you know, historical
exegesis.
What?
Which mystics?
Well, I'm thinking of any medieval mystic, I think, has a fluidity of metaphor, but...
Hildegard of Bingen.
Hildegard of Bingen, but Bernard of Clairvaux or whoever. Some are much more explicit and developed, the most obvious being Julian of Norwich, who really develops the kind of male, I mean, she creates a whole theology that integrates male and female aspects of God. Are you familiar with Julian of Norwich? She was a Benedictine anchorite of the 14th century. Her writings were basically preserved by the English Benedictines when they fled from England at the Reformation and carried all their books with them. But nobody had really read her stuff until about, I don't know what, 1930, and they said, oh, isn't that interesting? If they read it a couple centuries earlier, they probably would have burned it, you know. But yeah.
I think it's interesting that you identify the literalism with a scientific approach when, of course, 20th century science is entirely metaphor, model, and allegory.
Yeah, but that's really a modern scientific recognition, and I think a lot of our theological literalism is now a very obsolete scientific.
Mm-hmm. You know? And of course, the literalists, the biblical literalists, are unable to take even 19th century, let alone 20th century.
Yeah, but I do think they're very entranced with science in a kind of a pre-scientific way. I mean, they want to prove scientifically that creation took place in just thus and so a way and so on like that. So they.
Are you suggesting in a way then that that really fundamentalism could only arise in that context? Or
yeah, I think fundamentalism arises. Whatever. In the context of a society that's lost an understanding of the metaphorical, yeah. Understanding of language, and for whom scientific fact is the only truth, and therefore you have to kind of prove that everything that's true is true because it's a scientific fact. It's the what I call the 12 impossible things you believe before breakfast approach to faith. which is that you have a kind of laundry list, virgin birth, resurrection, so which you have to take as literal historical facts. And to me, you know, they would be sort of just oddities as historical facts. It's really only when you understand the religious metaphorical meaning that in fact they become religious truths.
Dr. Ruther, what is the importance of the gender issues in God talk when people who tend to think about these kinds of things are into process theology or into a more image of God in transcendence? In other words, people in discussions with me have said, well, I don't really think of God as a man because God is just this great power that's really so much more than any human being. So what's the point of talking about God as a woman, because isn't that a step backwards since we know that God transcends gender? And I never know quite what to say.
Well, I think that the problem is that when people deny that there's any gender issue, what often they're doing is sneaking it in and not acknowledging it. So they say, well, God is a great power that's beyond all gender, and he. And so suddenly you discover at the pronouns that they really can't ever say, well, he and she. In other words, that they kind of give themselves away, that they still think in terms of kind of abstract, you know, ever more transcendent maleness. but I think you don't get to... I think it's important to say God really is beyond gender, but we also have to balance that by saying that we only know from concrete experience. And our concrete experience includes male experience, female experience, and so on. And so we're not going to get to that larger thing unless we're willing to kind of go through a process of being able to acknowledge female as well as male metaphors as appropriate, and then say neither of them are literal.
Well, I asked a similar question to Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza when uh-huh. she was in Fresno several weeks ago. And she said, just ask them who they pray to. And I can see, you know, in the sense of the immediacy of prayer, you know, that you're either hoping for an aspect of Divine Mother's comfort or the strength and guidance from God the Father. But then even there you get caught in idolatry if you see it in a limited way. And, you know, it's hard to find the place that people can connect to in their own personal experience for the feminine aspects of God when it's just not been reflected in our experience.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not in our hymn book. It's not anywhere. And so it just is uncomfortable sometimes to try and create it, and then somebody is like, well, you're being real artificial.
Yeah. Well, I think when you connect that with experience, and that's what I really want to sort of move to in the next couple of days, you get a lot of very complex things, and there are a lot of issues to unpack. One of them is the immediate tendency to say God in male imagery, God in female imagery, as God in masculine imagery and God in feminine imagery, I'd like to distinguish between those two, because I think we need to get a language for God in relationship to gender that doesn't immediately stereotype male imagery as power, force, and domination, female imagery as passive nurture, etc., which then immediately then says that's what men and women should be. It was the imagery for God that deflects right back to stereotypic human roles, you know, confining males to, I think, a somewhat undesirable partial humanity as well as female. So I think what's interesting and what's useful to look back on those good old ancient gods and goddesses is that they were deity in male and female form, but they were not deity in masculine and feminine form. In other words, the male gods have all the complex emotions of a full human being, which cry and produce and are interested in fertility and are angry, and so are the females. And so they don't fall into our stereotypic female nurturing fertility mother male ruler, but they are complex beings, male and female. So I think we need to draw over inclusive gender imagery, but in a way that helps us to break those simple stereotypes of, you know, male equals masculinity, force, violence, power, invulnerability, and, you know, female is the sort of
does
the opposite.
Does it help at all to understand ourselves more as male, female at the same time?
I think this is actually a whole part of an interactive process.
In the last session, I was in a group and we were working on female images of God, and I gave some observations, and one of the women said, and you were never a mother, you know, as though you know, this kind of perception or experience should be denied me because I'm male. Well, I'm not just male, I'm female too.
Well, you certainly, I guess I'd like to say that you have all the nurturing capacities that we have stereotypically given only to mothers. And it may be, you know, if you think about the biblical God as having womb agony, this may be in fact a way to say that the male God has mothering capacities. It's just a way to give a fuller humanity in a sense to fatherhood, as much as it is to kind of split off those capacities as just female.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, there's a much more complex aspects of all this, which I'm sure Mary is taking up as well. And again, we'll pick up on some of this tomorrow, but thank you very much.
Thank you.